This podcast is made for people like you. Thank you for being there. Welcome to the GMS Magazine podcast, episode 437, a podcast about the people who make and the people who play tabletop board games and role-playing games. In this episode, Chris and I talk about whether we should separate the art from the artist. If you would like to participate or sponsor this podcast, or if you would like to send us your questions or comments, do get in touch, please. We'd love that. You can email me on podcast@gmsmagazine.com or find me on Twitter at us at GMS Magazine. And Chris is at DSSXMachina. And please, 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 please leave a review about the podcast in whatever platform you listen. It really helps a lot and it means the world to us. Okay, so I'm recording now. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello. Are we going to keep doing this pretending that we've just started to talk when in reality we've been talking for about 10 minutes now when we start the podcast?
Well, it's one of those situations. That's part of the illusion. Like, hey, and like, oh, great, haven't seen you in 3 seconds.
Yeah, but yeah,
you know, increase the illusion. Like, a podcast I listen to. They talk about stuff and you're like, I know you guys have talked for about a half an hour before the camera rolls, but sometimes they talk about it and they go, okay, let's hold off. Don't talk about this. Let's save it for the recording. And so sometimes they'll kind of quickly discuss matters and then they'll hold off and then try to get some spontaneity. Right.
Yeah. Which we're not very good at.
Well, it depends entirely on the, oh, but speaking of which, guess what I got in the mail?
What? Oh, you didn't.
I did.
Oh,
I did
get, awesome.
Now, that being said, because of the season, the chances of us playing any games between now and Christmas is pretty slim.
Right.
So I've wrapped it so my wife does not know that she's getting this product. And hopefully we will then play it soon because we'll get some friends together and play it. And then we'll probably, and then we could do like a twofer review, you and I.
Does she listen to the podcast?
My wife does not. She doesn't listen to podcasts.
Okay, so can we tell the listeners what we're talking about? Because yes. I'm guessing at least one of them is going to be wondering if it is the Dune game.
It is the Dune game. It is, yes. House Secrets finally showed up. I am looking forward to it. We definitely enjoyed the last one, and she's a big fan of the book series, and we all love the movie. With the new Dune coming on Blu-ray in early January, I think I'm going to try to get the game out and played ready for review by the time that comes out so we can ride the coattails of that.
I intend on playing because I've already opened it and I have read the rules. Mm-hmm. So I know what's inside the box and it's not a lot.
No, like I said, once again, when you're dealing with an app-driven game, like even the same thing with Chronicles of Crime, there was like 30 cards and that was about it.
Okay, no, sorry. I just, I was worried for a second there because you're moving your seat. And for a second there, I thought there was somebody behind you. And I thought, oh my God, if your wife's heard you, then that's Christmas fucked.
If my wife's here, it'd be very, very distressing because if she's supposed to be at work, somebody comes behind me and be like, Chris, there's somebody in the house.
So I would be worried. Okay, fine, fair enough. Okay, so we are going to talk about the Dune game that you've got and I've got and we're going to play and we're going to review in the foreseeable future, very soon indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Ignacy, for sending that. And it is
very much
appreciated. Very much indeed. And I have to say, the game looks gorgeous inside. You don't know what's inside, do you?
No, like I said, I got it like 4 or 5 packages because I got the air conditioner for my mother because I'm getting an air conditioner for my mother. And then I got a bunch of other things. So I wrapped up a bunch. We have like 12 board games underneath the tree. So much. We have so much stuff under our tree. We actually have another tree with a note saying see other tree. So we have a second tree with presents under it as well. Because my wife, I have friends and family that just like, oh no, we don't do the Christmas. We don't do the giving thing. We just enjoy ourselves company. And then I'm with a wife that's like, I'm wrapping everything. I'm individually wrapping every single, you know, mint and chocolate. She buys stuff for herself and then wraps it for herself. She just loves opening things. Plus, she has a memory like a sieve. So she actually does. So she'll buy something for herself, wrap it, and then not know what it is when she opens it later for herself.
Listeners, if you can hear some funky noises, that's because my dog is trying to kill me. And I'm biting him. Yeah. So, okay, so we've talked about the Dune game, but this is not what today is meant to be all about. Sorry, my dog just dropped on the floor. It fell.
Fell down some stairs.
Yeah, no, I don't have stairs. I don't have stairs, so he cannot do that. But he's going to go out of the room in a minute because he's being annoying now. Go, piss off. Piss off. He's not pissing off. He's not very good at pissing off. So anyway, we're going to talk about the separation of art and the artist and the game designer and the whatever, which I have strong views about. And I have the feeling that you have strong views about because we have not discussed this before the podcast. This is the first time that you and I are going to contrast our views on this very topic.
My views are complex. So it's one of those situations where for me on this topic, I am more about asking questions rather than making statements because I have my upbringing mm-hmm. and then I have my political view, the modern view, and I feel like there's a bit of a cognitive dissonance going on. There's a part of me that's just like, you know, I won't buy anything from Kellogg's because of their policy towards, you know, their union employees. I won't support this company because of their political views. But then some people say it shouldn't matter what they believe in. It should just be matter what they make. And if we hold corporations to it, why can't we hold individual artists? And it's one of those situations where I have friends who are artists, and I'm very happy that some of them, I don't know their political views. I'm like, as long as I am ignorant and you don't share with anybody what your views are, we're good. In some situations, I would rather not know their views on topics than know, because there's always that chance that they may say something that you don't like. And you're like, oh man, I can't support you now. But there's also a part of me that looks at the past and goes, we never knew. Like, I don't believe in retroactively canceling people.
I do.
I think that's something that's a consequence of the modern age. But I think once, if you are been dead 50, 60 years, it's hard for me to support canceling someone who's been dead a half a century. Which brings up the, you know, it's tricky. And that comes up to two specific things. One is Elia Kazan. Elia Kazan, one of the most famous screenwriters in history, wrote... One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I think, Bridge on the River Kwai. And he also was like a person who named names at the McCarthy trials. And as a result, he was effectively shunned and ostracized by Hollywood. So when he was finally awarded a lifetime achievement in the late 90s or early 2000s at the Oscars, a good number of people refused to stand and clap because of his past. And it was interesting when you talked with Harlan Ellison, who's a very famous acerbic author who passed away a few years ago, mm-hmm. he believes that a person's work and a person's personality do not commingle. It doesn't matter. Like, he was very stressful. That's why the only awards he respected were Writers Guild awards, because the scripts were blank. You didn't know who wrote them. So you couldn't vote for someone based on a political belief because you wouldn't know who wrote the script. A judge would be given stories without authors, and you'd have to judge it based on the work. You weren't allowed to say, I can't vote for this person because of political beliefs, because you didn't know who they were. That's a very interesting decision. I don't know if they still do it, but they did it for a while. And that's a very interesting thing, that fact that if you look at an artist, a painting, you think it's beautiful, does your opinion of it change once you know who painted it?
Okay, in what you've said, there is several things that we need to unpack here, because I have taken a few notes, and I have at least four different points that bar discussing. Firstly, you mentioned about Kellogg's, and if you don't buy Kellogg, then separating the company from what the company does and what the company makes and the artist, well, two different things altogether, because... I don't think we can compare art with a company and the product that a company...
Okay, I mean, I like that. I agree with that.
No, the product that a company manufactures and something that an artist makes is just not really on the same board at all.
Seeing it a lot, with especially with video games. People buy video games from companies that are horrible because they want to play the video game and they can't. I look at that and go, you know, I won't buy anything from Activision or Blizzard because of their policies. I won't buy anything from Ubisoft. I can do that, but some people are like, they made the game. The company is horrible, but I'm still buying the game. And I'm like, yeah, but I can't.
Well, okay, but that's another thing altogether. And then we should get into the debate as to whether our games are art or not. That's an entire topic altogether. But even if we don't discuss that now, is this safe to say that games are made by artists?
Yes.
Okay, so from that point of view, the complexity of what you're mentioning regarding video games is the fact that you may not want to support the company, but if you don't support the company, then you're not supporting the artists. And there are many artists working on those video games, and some of them are worth supporting. So that adds a level of complexity and nuance, which would be very difficult to process. But I also think if we go into the realm of video games, then we're stepping a few steps too far from the topic and the core of this podcast, which should be board games and role-playing games. So I am going to equate video games to board games and role-playing games in the sense that regardless of whether they are considered art or not, that's, again, we will discuss that in another episode, it is safe to say that they are all made by artists. So the thing is that who don't you want to support? Don't you want to support the art, the illustrator, illustrators? Don't you want to support the author? Don't you want to support the publisher? That's a very tricky one, because you may not want to support Wizards of the Coast, but if you don't, then you're not supporting some of the amazing people who actually write their games. The same goes with Paizo or Green Ronin or whoever, because of the views of the company or some people that are visible within the company. So that is a very, very tricky one in and on itself. Also, you mentioned about, you know, canceling people who are dead. I don't see how you can cancel somebody who's dead. They are already canceled by nature. How can you cancel somebody who's dead?
Well, there's been this push to try to kind of, like, for decades and decades, people adored H.P. Lovecraft, but now that his views on many topics have come to light, some people have been stressing that we should probably turn the volume down on him and his achievements. And I'm one of those situations, just like, at this point, I mean, it's one of those situations where there are people who made decisions back in the 80s because the culture was different then, and they can look at it and go, you know, the world evolves. And H.P. Lovecraft was a product of his time. Would he have still felt this if he was alive today? And that's one other thing to consider.
Okay, well, two things about that. Lovecraft was bigoted even for his time. I mean, there are letters sent to... by Howard, you know, Conan's man, who was also pretty bigoted himself, saying, wow, dude, you go way too far. So even by the time, he was a horrific, horrible kind of person. But I concede the point that we don't know what he would be like if he were alive today. That we just cannot possibly know. And I think canceling his work is just as stupid, because at the end of the day, I think the important thing is to realize the kind of person who wrote and to figure out the nuance and the reflection of that man's personality into his work. Because whoever said that you cannot, the person is not intrinsically linked to their work is kidding themselves. That's it. It's impossible, absolutely impossible for an artist not to reflect their views, their ethos, their self within the art, which is why artists change as they age and their work changes as they age. I don't think there is a serious artist out there who used to be or used to do exactly the same thing when they were 20 that they do when they're 50.
I agree.
Because we change, and that changes. You know, I am not producing the same artwork that I was producing 20 years ago or 10 years ago, because I am not the same person, and that shows very much. So I don't think that we can separate it. And cancel culture is not new. I mean, that's not a modern invention that people are claiming, oh, this is happening now. That is complete bollocks. And anyone who's lived through the satanic panic, just to say something gaming related, has lived through cancellation, you know, culture.
The thing about cancel culture, the idea of cancel culture, the reason why a lot of people are hating the cancel culture is because they're not the ones doing the canceling anymore.
And and things they like are being canceled.
Yeah, you know? The thing was the fact that the people that are getting canceled today were the people that were doing the canceling metaphorically yesterday.
Correct.
We are canceling people that are criticizing and passing judgment on those that are suppressing the rights of minorities. But you could also say that suppressing the rights of minorities was canceling in its own regard. So,
well, that's the thing. That's what I tell everybody when they say, oh, well, cancel culture. I say, listen, dudes, people like me have been canceled for centuries.
Exactly.
Literally. So please quit the bollocks. And don't tell me that this is a modern invention of the woke culture, because that's just complete and utter bullshit that ignores how many ethnicities, cultures, sexual orientations, everything that's been cancelled in the past gets completely erased by this notion that is something new. That is bollocks.
But going to what you're saying earlier, though, and this is one of those situations, what if tomorrow, I actually don't know if this is actually the case, but let's say, we find out that Bob Kane was a homophobe and an anti-Semite. Do we look at Batman any differently? We already know that Bob Kane wasn't exactly a great person anyway, because he basically stole most of the credit from Finger. I can't remember his first name, but his last name was Finger, who contributed to that Batman mythos more than most people understood, to the point that it was only recently that he got credit. So we already know that Bob Kane is not the nicest person, but he's still the person who's credited as Batman. What if we found out that he was a horrible person? Do we look at Batman any differently? Or it's like, no, it's divvied so much. Batman has been owned by so many people now. We look at him going, wait a second. If too many people have their fingers in the creative process of Batman, Batman doesn't change because we find out that the original guy who penned it 100 years ago or so was a bad person. That's an interesting question for me to pose. Like I said, I'm just asking questions because I don't really fully.
Okay, but there is an issue in there, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said multiple people have worked on Batman, and Batman has changed regarding of what artist has worked on them. So I bet you anything. I mean, can we look at the overall nearly 100 years old Batman? Because Batman is going to be 100 fairly soon. Can we look at the Batman and, you know, judge its own, the whole lifespan based on just the inventor? No. Can we look at what the inventor of Batman did with that character and look at the signs of bigotry or misogyny or whatever it is within that period of time? Absolutely, yes. And I will give you the reverse example. Can we look at the Matrix now, you know, the original Matrix, as an allegory for trans people and the transition of trans people, which is something that barely anybody thought about at the time?
No one really considered it, because at the time even today, I look at that and going, wow, that's fascinating. I actually still have trouble seeing it because I still look at the Matrix for its religious parables, and I never noticed the allegories. Of course, when you look at it now, especially exactly. when you look at the other things that they've made, like Cloud Atlas and Sense8, you go, oh yeah, this is something that they've been talking about for a while.
Exactly.
And then when not one, but both of the Wachowskis transition, you go, oh, okay, well now it's kind of, it's easier to see it now. It'd be interesting to see if they put any more of that in the new film coming out as we record this in less than 2 weeks.
Correct. But my point is, if something happens to the author in life that makes them look back and think, oh, maybe this was an allegory for what they were going through in their lives, why shouldn't we do the same for bigotry and horrific people? You know,
that's a very good point.
Why can't we look back at, you know, everybody says about, oh my God, how could Orson Scott Card, who is a raging homophobe and a piece of shit the size of Gibraltar, how could he write Ender's Game, who is such a beautiful allegory for, well, blah, 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 blah. I said, well, maybe we're looking at Ender's Game in a different manner. Maybe he wasn't the same person then.
That's actually a very good point. Actually, I really appreciate you brought that up, because that was actually one of the things, because some people have stated that one of the reasons why the Ender's Game movie failed was because of this organized boycott, because of the modern views of Orson Scott Card. Now, it should be noted that Orson Scott Card himself, famously, if you ever read the sequels to Ender's Game, you'll find something that's very unusual, that he seems to have he seemed to disrespect his own franchise. If you ever read the sequels to Ender's Game, the later books make a point of almost deconstructing and reversing the views placed in Ender's Game, where suddenly it starts presenting Ender not in any way as a protagonist. He starts stressing that he wasn't as good as he thought he was, and it starts starts pumping up other characters as being more important and better than he is. And yes, you're right. People's views change. Sometimes they go progressive and sometimes they go conservative, and sometimes they don't. But that's a very interesting thing, because when the movie came out, there was a lot of push. Like Robert Orci, who's the producer, said he wasn't aware of Card's views when he took development of the film adaptation. And he said that the movie should be judged on its message, not the personal beliefs of its original author. That's a direct quote from the producer, who had minimal involvement in the film. Orci also stated, I actually did research on this, if it's on the screen, then I think it's fair game. Lionsgate, who made the film, released a statement stating that we obviously do not agree with the personal views of Orson Scott Card, while highlighting the company's longtime support of LGBT community. So is there a way of saying, like, look, Orson Scott Card wrote the original book. His views today are abhorrent. That doesn't change the fact that we think the original work is solid and the movie should stand on its own. But a lot of people disagreed.
Well, I think what people disagreed, and in my case, this is the reason why I didn't want to go to the cinema to watch that film, is that I didn't want a single penny of my money to go to Orson Scott Card's pocket. And every single ticket that is sold to watch that film, a little bit of money is going to go there, even if it's just a penny, but it's going to go.
It depends on the contract. It may be a situation where they paid him outright and then they got the money off the profit, which means he already got his money. Now we're talking about whether or not the company gets the money off of that production, because we never know the agreement. Sometimes, most of the time, actors get a piece of the pie. Directors get a piece of the pie. When you're buying the rights off of an author, they seldom get a piece of the pie. It depends on how well established they are. Like George R. R. Martin gets a piece of Game of Thrones. But that's because it's a very popular franchise. But we don't know whether or not Orson Scott Card, because some films have come out or have come out with that controversy and have stated, like, and some role-playing games have done as well, where there's been a controversial person and they said, look, when you buy this book, this person's not getting a dime of it. And some people, like some companies have stated that same thing. Like, look, you are supporting the people who made this work, not the work that's derivative.
Okay, two things about that. Firstly, I don't know what contract they have and I don't want to risk it.
Oh yeah, we have no idea.
I play safe. I understand that there may be many different types of contracts, or I don't know which one, so I don't want to risk any money going into his pocket. But we also get the domino effect of people who don't really know the views of Scott Card, watch Ender's Game, and then go and buy the book, and I will get some money into his pockets, or buy something else that he has produced, some comics or comic books or whatever it is. The problem with giving exposure to the work of people who think the way that he does is that then they can get some customers. And I don't think that's a good idea. It's entirely up to people. Again, I think people should be entitled to vote with the wallet. I do all the time. And I don't like buying things from some people, and thus I'd rather spend my money somewhere else. That's it. That's the way it goes. And I mean, that's perfectly entitled. Everybody's perfectly entitled. As everybody would be perfectly entitled to go out there now and buy every single word that Scott Card's written, or Lovecraft, or whoever. And that would be perfectly fine. They are entitled to do that. And I don't think people should be chastised for doing so. I think they should be chastised for doing so if they support the same shit that the authors support. But that's a different matter altogether. Would I want to discuss that work with those people? No. Would I want to share a table with people who do that sort of thing? Probably not, because the possibilities and risk of them being just as much of a bigot as the author are way too much. I don't want to be put in that position. So,
What are your thoughts on the idea? I think this is me. I'm not trying to bait your response here, but I'm curious about the idea. Like, once again, talking about what we said earlier about McCarthy, about the guilty by association, where if a book for a role playing game, for example, hires an artist, but it turns out that artist was controversial. Let's say you see bigot, homophobe, whatever the case may be. Well, you see the generic bigot. Let's say a game hires an artist. They tell this person what to draw. Then we come out later and say, we find out that this artist was a bigot. I have thoughts on this. Do we punish that company? Does that company then have to cut that art? Or it's like, no. We paid for that commission. That illustration is based off what we told him. He's not imbuing his own creativity into this. We've already paid for that piece. Should we include that artwork, and should we be punished? I obviously don't think so. I think at that point you can stop working with them in the future, but if you have artwork by this person, I don't think it really matters unless that person was creatively involved in the process. Like if I hire an artist for Amethyst or any of other products, and we find out later this person was a bigot, I don't think I have to go back and redo all the artwork of that publication, because it's my story, my artistic integrity. Judge me on what I view, but not on the people I hire.
Well, That's a tricky one. Yeah. And there is a very specific case in the RPG world with this plonker that I dislike very much, who wrote this very famous OSR game. I don't want to even name him, because I find him such an appalling character. And he repeatedly hired Zach.
Oh,
to keep doing work.
Yeah, I know the Zach of which you speak.
Correcto.
Very, very infamous within the industry.
Correcto. I could give you another example within Kickstarter with this fellow, I can't remember his name now, who tried to get through the back door Adam Coble into his project.
I heard of the story as well.
You know, and people boycotted them. And, the whole thing was a complete and utter kerfuffle. It was a ridiculous farce. Now, if you hire somebody in true ignorance of their views or their behavior, and you have the work done, I think it depends on how people react. I mean, as in companies react to the criticism. If you tell me, as soon as this print is out, I will redo the work so this guy is no longer there. Fine, no problem. I will wait and I will not buy the book, but I will not criticize you because I agree with you. There is little else you can do. You know, the work is already produced. You have already paid for it. So, changing it, sometimes it's just not possible. You can't.
Yeah, so from a budget point of view or what have you. It's like, so this brings up something, and I'll tell, and I do make things personal. So, and I'll be 100% honest, and I've had this conversation, but I've never had this conversation publicly. So my company, when we first started off, contracted out several artists. Now, for a variety of reasons, nothing related to the political views, because at this point, I had no idea what they were. most of these artists fell away because I didn't really care for their quality or their business etiquette, which has nothing to do with political views. And eventually it got down to me keeping one person, an artist that I have worked with. He is responsible for 99% of the illustrations in the first Amethyst book and 100% of the illustrations in all the subsequent books. Right. This artist, his name is Nick Greenwood. He is out of North Carolina. We only met physically twice when we met at a convention after nearly 10 years working together. Now, I know that that Nick is a Mormon, which is not a derogatory term. I'm not wording the derogatory term, but he is a Mormon. And I am an atheist. So you can imagine right away that there could be conflict of interest between our work. Now, it should be noted that Amethyst as a setting, one of the things that I feel is one of the definitive aspects of the setting beyond the mix of magic and technology is the fact that it's a godless setting, meaning the fact that it is set in the real world. And I made a point of saying, I'm not going to create proof of God, because if you make proof of God in the real world setting, you open up a big can of worms. You can say, oh, yeah, Paylor is real. And you know, and these other pantheon of D&D gods are real in your fantasy world. But if you're setting something in the real world, you can't say, oh, yes, by the way, the Jews were right, to quote Rowan Atkinson. It becomes incredibly controversial. So I said, no, in this story, God is as silent and as unproven as anything. You still require faith. There is no proof. And I created the setting in such a way that when you create that, where magic can exist without proof of God. And that was a very complex aspect of the setting. However, my views are pretty obvious. The main characters in the novel are atheists, and the story does have a lot of parables about our belief in fantasy worlds and our belief in mythology and our belief in religion and how sometimes those can blur together. So you can imagine that someone who's a devout Mormon might have an issue with that story. Now, he loves the work, he loves the imagination, and he's had conversations with his wife, and they're okay with, like, they understand the message I'm saying, and they know the fact that I'm not a militant atheist. I'm actually an agnostic, but I am not a person that's trying to crap on religion, even though I do it very often publicly, but in my work I'm not. But this brings up something else a little further than that. So that becomes the conflict between my artist and myself, which we don't have. Although I have a project I'm working on for a future Kickstarter called Heavenfall, which is a post-apocalyptic story where hell rises up to protect humanity from the fall of heaven. Which, because if you actually look at the Book of Revelations, there is as much a cosmic horror to Revelations than H.P. Lovecraft, the idea of monstrous angels that are not humanoid. They are beasts. If you look at Ezekiel and Revelations, there are some astoundingly horrendous imagery, and creating a situation where heaven are the bad guys and hell has to rise up to protect humanity from the end of all existence. And I have artists that I have tapped, but I have kept Nick at a distance because I don't want to pressure him to work on the project if he feels uncomfortable doing it. And I will respect him if he decides not to. However, this brings up something else that happened a couple of years ago. Do you know about sick puppies?
Rings a bell, but I wouldn't be able to tell you what it was all about.
All right, I think sick puppies or something else is a similar term. But anyway, so this goes back 8-9 years ago to the Hugos, one of the most famous, if not prestigious, creative writing awards for genre, right up there with the Nebulas and the Writers Guild Awards. Mm-hmm. Hugos are extremely popular. But to get yourself into the nomination is something that could be manipulated through basically ballot stuffing. Awards are done through committee, I believe, but you can get nominations into the door through ballot stuffing. So two Pacific right-wing authors, independently and then eventually united to form several lobbyist groups to ballot stuff the Hugos with conservative and right-leaning authors. This came about because the Hugos was pushing more progressive, and a very famous Black author had swept the awards twice in a row because she's amazing. But they, of course, took that as an insult and created this movement to try to get right-wing creators onto the Hugo nomination. It was proved controversial. It proved to be fruitless because none of their nominations made it through. None of them won. They were literally, in some cases, received 0% of the votes. So, yes. Now, it should be noted, of course, it's Hugo's encompasses not only authors, but visual art, cover art, fantasy art, sci-fi art, because it encompasses everything within the fantasy science fiction genre artwork, regardless of format. So Nick Greenwood, that year, got nominated. Why? Well, because he is Orson Scott Card's primary illustrator. He did the cover of several of the Ender's Games. He also did a lot of the artwork for Orson Scott Card's Medicine Show, which was an anthology series that he made. And because, you know, because his views of him and his family, he got in there. Now, he was not associated with the group. None of the authors were. These guys just basically grabbed the list of authors they felt were right-leaning or conservative and pushed these people in. So Nick wasn't a person that was associated with them. He just kind of got swept up because of his political views. So as a result, he got moved into being nominated. And so he now is Hugo nominated Nick Greenwood. And I have Hugo nominated Nick Greenwood doing my artwork, even though that nomination came about through an extreme level of controversy that happened that year. A nomination that he might not have received if it wasn't for this campaign. Now I know Nick's views, and I personally think that Nick's a moderate. I don't think he's like, he voted Romney back in the election with Obama, but Romney is now considered a moderate because Romney hates Trump, right? Romney despises the fanatical progressive, the fanatical reverse movement of the conservative party. He dislikes Trump. He dislikes the people who voted for Trump, and that's why Romney is now considered this outsider. But he voted for Romney. When Trump came to power, I could tell that his family were not happy. They saw right through Trump's BS. They knew he was not a religious person. They wanted Romney because Romney's a Mormon. So I know that his views isn't as right as the current conservative party. But I make a point to never ask him for his specific political views. And thankfully he doesn't have a Facebook profile, so I never see what he posts. I see what his wife posts, and I can go, okay, I'm just not gonna ask her for any more clarification on that. So this has been our very interesting relationship between him and me, right? I know that he is a conservative Christian, but I know that I don't consider him to have, I've never gotten the impression from him. He has never stated anything that has been homophobic, sexist, or racist.
Okay.
I just know that he wrote Christian conservative because that's his upbringing. So as long as I don't know, I give myself away because Nick and I have this working relationship now for nearly 13, 14 years. He's the best artist I've ever worked with. He is extremely dedicated to the craft and he's always committed to facilitating my vision. And I've never had a better working relationship with an artist, and I have worked with many. So I'm in a situation where I look at this and going, I state ignorance. I do not want to know about his political views, and we kind of go on from there. It's been a very tenuous situation, but if someone said, why do you work with this artist? He's a conservative. And I go, you know, I do believe that he is an intelligent, passionate individual. We do not agree on our religious views. I do not know his political views, and that's where it stands for that. And until he comes out and says something horribly ignorant, I will continue to defend him because I do fall behind that vein of ignorance going, as long as I don't know, you know, if we had never knew what H.P. Lovecraft thought, we never would have canceled him today. It's one of those situations that people keep their political views. In the same way that people kept their progressive views ignorant in the 60s or 70s, people nowadays are kind of keeping their conservative views close to the chest because they know that if their personal views got public, it would be disastrous. Unfortunately, so many people can't keep their mouths to their opinions to themselves, which is the reason why so many people are getting canceled.
Okay. So,
long rant about the
No, okay, but several things about that. Firstly, I think you have to acknowledge the fact that working with a man is risky, because if at some point anything comes out from him for whatever reason, or by association, but by whatever it is his wife is saying, and he gets splashed, you are going to get splashed. And yep. I understand what you're saying about feigning ignorance or claiming ignorance, but I'm sorry, it doesn't really follow. Okay, I am biased, and because I've been bitten and burned way too many times. But as far as I'm concerned, if you are from a conservative Christian background, the likelihood is that you are going to have some pretty abhorrent views.
Right.
It's more likely than not.
Because I was raised in a religious, devout religious household.
Yeah, but you're no longer there.
My sibling, like my sister, and other relatives, are not practicing, but they're still very Christian. My sister is incredibly progressive, but she also is an intelligent person. Like, she's very progressive. She's very progressive in that standpoint. Okay. But she's also considers herself a Christian. I don't.
There is a difference there, and is that you do know that she's a progressive. You don't know what your friend is, and the fact that you don't want to find out, to me, that says that you are worried or could be. You know, you kind of know that you could get an answer you don't like and you don't want to get, because that would put you in a position of having to choose whether to keep working with him or not. And that's why you're keeping yourself ignorant. And I'm sorry to say, but it doesn't cut it. Doesn't cut it.
In the situation with Nick, thankfully, in the conversation we have, where we have brought it up, I've gotten the impression that he is definitely more moderate. Like, he's one of those situations where he seems to actively not, he's not interested in politics. He would rather just sit and draw and do artwork. And he was raised a Mormon. I've always got the impression that he's one of those people. It's like my dad. My dad is a devout Christian like my mom. But once my mom got sick, he didn't go to church, you know? My dad's like, well, my wife's a Christian, so I'm a Christian. I'm not going to get in the way. So she's going to go to church. I'm going to go to church. But I always felt that my dad was about 70% there. My mother was 100. And I always got the impression with Nick that his wife's 100 and he's about 70 or 80. Like, yeah, he believes in it. He obviously believes in God. But when we talked about politics, he'd be like, and something the Conservative Party would do when he came on conversation, I can see him go, I can see his heart sink like, yeah, like he's not very happy with the direction. I know that his wife's not happy with the direction the Conservative Party is. So I'm glad that he's not a Trump man, because that would be like, oh crap, to have that line.
Look, I am perhaps because I don't have a economic interest as much as you do, in the sense that I am not producing a paid-for product. But you know, I used to have a podcast partner, Rob, for some years ago. And I knew that he voted Trump at the time, but he also told me that he voted Trump because of lack of other choice, because he didn't feel that Hillary was at all an option for him. And thus the only other option available was Trump. And you know, I at the time I was stupid enough to believe him. And then later on, he came out saying some absolutely disgusting and horrific things. I stopped doing the podcast with him. I deleted all the episodes that I did with him and I blocked him in Facebook, because I don't want to have people like that around. And I don't want the risk of somebody associated me and the product that I do, the podcast and whatever it is that I do, with whatever it is that he said. I don't want to be splashed by the shit that he produces. That's it.
Yeah, and that's where going back to where I have several friends who are artists, and some of them are much more high profile than some of the artists. Like, one thing I'll say about Nick, like it's not like Jamie Jasso or Jason Engel, who are very well known artists that I've worked with in the past. you know, I don't know what their political views are, because, but they are very high profile, very high. Engel has an illustration in almost every single D&D book made in history. He has fingers everywhere.
Yes.
Jamie Jasso, I hired him when he was a nobody, and now he works for Bungie with Halo and Destiny. So he's definitely got a good career. And he wrote a bunch of the most, drew some of the most famous illustrations for Magic the Gathering. So he's extremely famous. So when I say, oh, Jamie Jasso did my cover, a lot of people said, holy crap, how did you get Jamie Jasso to do your cover? I go, well, when I knew him, he was a college kid and he wasn't working for Magic. But if one of these guys that I've worked with said, oh, yeah, they came out as being bigoted, that's high profile. That's something where it's kind of hard to ignore. I have hired other artists, and if Catherine Dinger, who was another artist I employed, who's not someone who's well known, came up as being a, found out she made a post that was bigoted, I'm like, well, I won't hire her, but no one's going to know. Like, no one's going to grab these names and do research and go, hey, why are you hiring this person? And I'm like, how do you know who this person is? Mm-hmm. Right. I have an artist we hired up for Neurospasta who worked with Nick Greenwood named Wayne Miller. And Wayne Miller, I have no idea what his political views are. But we're on Facebook and he hasn't said anything, but if he says something bigoted, and I'm like, well, I guess I'm not hiring you, but no one's going to come at me and go, why did you hire Wayne Miller? He's a bigot. Like, how do you know who Wayne Miller is? Because, it's not like Dave Toschini where he's high profile, right? We go back to the situation where he drew a robot. I'm the person with the political views. Come after me for my political views, and quite a few people do, because a lot of right-wingers really dislike what I do. One guy called my right pretentious fan wank, which I thought was very interesting. I always love it when somebody gives a bad review, and then they have to quote their credentials when they do it.
Well,
I'm
just amazed that guy could understand and spell pretentious. Usually they don't know words that long. But anyway,
one guy who disagreed with my political views in Amethyst, because like I said Amethyst has a lot of statements and presents humans as being mostly the bad guys, and he came out and said that my political views were bankrupt because I was stressing certain thoughts that were not associative with history, and then he brought up his degree, and I'm like, and the funny thing was is that people said this is not a realistic depiction of the future, which was Neurospasta. Like, this is not how the society would work with the United Nations, which is what the setting is about. I said, I had a United Nations lawyer as my technical advisor. So you have you have your reputation. I'm going to fall back on the guy that I actually brought on, a guy who worked at the United Nations. So I'm pretty sure I'm solid ground. But looking at Nick, I can divorce his political views from his art because his illustrations are reflective of my vision and not his.
Except there's one thing in there that it doesn't matter whether his illustrations are reflective of your work or his views. At the end of the day, if he said or did something wrong or bad for whatever reason, it doesn't matter what his illustrations are going to be like. It is his name and therefore yours and your work that would suffer the rage of everybody, rightly or wrongly. But it would be, because people would be going for the people. You know, people would be going for the person. And let's face it, when there is an outcry, nuance get reduced to a minimum.
Did I find that out yesterday?
Correct. So that is something that we have to be very, very careful. So I think when working with artists today to create your work, I think it is imperative to do some due diligence and find out what kind of person you're associating yourself with, because it will come and bite you in the ass in the future if anything comes out. And we have seen that sort of thing happening to Grid Ronin a few years ago. You know,
Green Ronin, yeah.
Yeah, when they thought that, again, I don't really want to name names because I don't want to, you know, stir the shit. But I mean, I know Green Ronin folk. I know Nicole Lindruz. I know Chris Premers. I know Steve Kensel.
I know Chris as well.
And they are incredibly progressive, open-minded, and good people. I mean, I absolutely adore them. And if anybody listening to this podcast has something bad to say about any of them, please keep it to yourself, because I ain't interested. So anyway, they had somebody working for them, and that person came, you know, there were some allegations of some abuse and inappropriate behavior. And people went after Green Ronin. And it's a bit like, wait a second, they did all the due diligence they could on the person, and something completely unknown.
Yeah, you can never know. Sometimes people have secrets, and sometimes they come up.
Correct. But at the very least, you can say, I did my due diligence and nothing came up. This is new and I didn't know. And this is what I am going to do about it, or about this person, now that I know. That's the difference. So I reckon that if anybody's going to work with an artist, due diligence is imperative, because otherwise part of the wrath that you may get if that person happens to be what we expect them not, it's kind of warranted. You should have known.
Yeah.
It's part of the process.
So in my situation, because my artist has never ever expressed any of his views, and on our conversations we've had, nothing's come up as a red flag. I'm not going to cancel or refuse to hire somebody on their religious beliefs, obviously.
No.
And because I will hire anybody if their beliefs, but it's one of those situations where if you make a statement, which is a suppression or an insult of a minority or ethnic group, that where things come into play. And I also don't feel comfortable going, you know, I need to make sure that it's one of those situations where Disney sees it all the time. They hire people and they work with them and they're like, as long and they vet them, but they never know what they might say. And next thing you know, Gianna Carano puts her foot in her mouth and Disney's like, well, we can't hire her anymore, and they have to let her go. And it's one of those situations where I'm, after 14 years, I'm not expecting that red flag to rise because I've worked with the person for such a long time. At this point, we're at that stage where I'm thinking, you know, if I'm hiring somebody now, there's that moment of caution where I'm like, okay, I got to make sure that this person is good. But when I look at an artist, I get artists that come to me all the time. And I look at artists and I test them on their artwork. At no point do I go, just to make sure, I have to, you know, I better make sure that, you know, if I'm going to get serious, I might vet them. I may see what their public profile is and see what they have to say. But a few years ago, I wouldn't have done that. I would have just looked at their quality of their artwork and not looked at their views. Nowadays, if an artist came up to me that I liked, I would, okay, before I get too serious, I'm going to check this guy's public profile and make sure I'm not stirring into controversy.
Correct.
Case in point, I was approached for Naramata from a company that wanted to distribute it. And then we find out 6 months later with their very famous frog inverted OK symbol. And I was like, hey, this thing's familiar. And I was like, ah, crap. It's the same guy who wanted it. And then I had to cut my ties with them. So this is something that's new to me now, that within the last year, I have to vet a personal relationship. But I never thought I had to do that before.
But I think that's very new for an awful lot of people. An awful lot of people need to get on with it, basically. I understand that it's not easy to do something that you haven't had to do in the past. And fair enough. You know, fair enough. I don't think anybody's going to be expecting you to do it pretty much right away. But it's something that has to be done. And I reckon that working with an artist and letting them know, because the way I have done it in the past, when I've published any books that required any kind of illustrations, is available, I literally went to the guy and said, look, this is who I am, this is what I do, this is what I think. And if you have any problem with it, then tell me now and don't work with me, because I ain't interested. And if you come out at some point saying shit like this, stuff like that, or things like those, that's it. We are not going to work together. So you need to be prepared to understand that if you work for me, you have part of the responsibility of not tanking my company. Thank you very much. And I expect certain behavior. So it's the kind of thing where I would go to your friend and say, you know, I can work with you. I love working with you. I don't think there is a problem or that you are a problematic. But if at some point you come out as a problematic, I will drop you like a lead balloon.
Yeah.
You know, and he should be aware of that, because then
conversations to that regard, fact that where like many years ago, we had a conversation, this is like 10 years ago, where we had the conversation about the fact that, you know, my work is not a, you know, in fact, I think he was more appreciative of the fact that I created a setting that said, no, you still have to believe in a God. There is no proof of God, because all I'm doing is enforcing the status quo. I'm not saying, oh, by the way, the Abrahamic God is correct. Like, no, you can worship. And the thing is, the idea with the cleric in my setting, although I'm going to be retconning that a little bit, is the fact that your synergy to magic is what grants you the power, your belief in the Almighty. So you could have an atheist cleric. And some people took real issue with that, saying, no, you can't take religion out of D&D. And I said, yes, you can. Watch. But I wanted to bring up something else quickly before we run out of time. And that is, now we've talked about the artist's political beliefs compared to his art.
Yeah.
What about the art itself? So let's ignore the artist, or let's assume that the artist has no red flags, but they draw something that's controversial. Now I'm flipping it. So now instead of the artwork being innocent and the artist being a red flag, what if the illustration's a red flag and the artist isn't?
Well, the thing is, I would take the illustration's red flag as an artist's red flag, because otherwise, why would they paint it?
Once again, it's one of those situations that, A, whether or not they're making a political statement. To get more specific, look at a situation where a person could be, once again, no red flag. We're not going to say whether or not they're progressive or restrictive or what have you. But they draw, and I'm not even saying they are showing or drawing racist imagery. I'm not even going to go that far. Because, as you said, that seems kind of weird. How can somebody draw something like that? Unless they've been told to draw that. And then, of course, we go after the person who commissioned the illustration for their political views. I'm talking about something that's a bit more vague. And that is the sexualization of fantasy, which is itself could be a topic in itself. But for the history of fantasy, since as long as we've had fantasy, there's been a mingling of sex with fantasy. Because sex is a fantasy in many ways. And fantasy has a sexual element to it. All the way back to the origins of fantasy, mythology, there was always something sexual. There was always something that was, women were voluptuous, sexual beings, men were dominant, powerful, strength of arms, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So this is thousands and thousands of years old. And then we have modern artists from the last 100 years, now work in fantasy, not like science fiction, but definitely in fantasy, that have continued that belief. We look at Conan, and once again, I'm ignoring the views of the author of Conan, I'm looking specifically at the illustrations of these artists. A good example, of course, would be Boris Vallejo. I collected some of these books when I was young. Most of the books I collected when I was youth are science fiction. Chris Voss, Tony Roberts, there's no people in them.
One thing, I absolutely love how you pronounce that.
Boris Vallejo?
Yeah.
Why, is it wrong?
Well, we would pronounce it as Vallejo.
Oh, bye. Well, thank you. I don't know what the correct pronunciation is.
I mean, me neither, because I don't know the origin of the surname, but in Spain, he is Boris Vallejo. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted you there. Vallejo. Sounds weird.
No, I'm curious. He's a Peruvian-American. He's Peruvian-American, so I have no idea how
If he's Peruvian and the surname he has a Spanish origin, then he's Vallejo.
Yeah, there you go. And if you look at his art book and look at his art, as we're not doing video, it's pretty straightforward.
Yes. I know his art.
Feminine form. His wife, Julie Benz, was his muse. So whenever you see a naked woman in a lot of his images, it's actually her. And she also draws similar illustrations because she was basically, she was his muse and also a fantastic talented painter on her own. And then we look at somebody else, Hajime Sorayama, another famous artist from that time period, who also paints a lot of nudity, and the terminology would be pinup girls, but there's a lot of nudity within their work. Chris Voss, who's one of the most famous sci-fi artists in history, who does the most amazing sci-fi. He did work for Star Trek, Star Wars. He designed the hero ship for Guardians of the Galaxy. Also drew the joy of sex back in the late 70s, and he drew a lot of naked women in that story as well. But now we look at this and going, and up until recently, you would have a sexual element to your illustrations. Look at the original cover for Riffs. Look at a lot of the illustrations. Hell, look at my first book for Foundations, that cover was forced on me. Do we look at this and going, this is no longer appropriate? Or is there still this place for this, regardless of gender, the sexualization, but most of the time it goes to women because nobody seems to be complaining whenever there's a sexualized man on a cover. But we do definitely see, like if we have a cover that has that Conan, huge muscles, loincloth, bare-chested. And then there's a scantily clad, voluptuous woman fantasy character next to that character. I never see people complaining about Conan. They're complaining about the sexualization of that character.
Yeah, but because there's a difference between the sexualization of a female figure, or a male figure for the matter, and the masculinization of the figure. And what they do with that kind of figures is to make it hyper masculine, not sexualize them at all. Okay. You don't see their balls being portrayed or their dick being marked upon or anything at all. In fact, you don't see any sexual traits in those pictures of men.
That's a very good point.
But you see all the sexual pose, the attitude, the expression. Men are not saying fuck me, women are. That is where the problem is. Now, is there a place for those kind of illustrations? Yes, when they are appropriate. But to have them as a rule, no. Is there a point in having a Conan illustration of a man with bulging muscles and absolutely perfectly positioned nipples in all over the body or whatever it is, and then having the woman on the altar? Well, no. Why don't you have the man on the altar and the woman having this absolutely beautifully muscled figure with a perfectly appropriate armor, chopping off the head of this fantastic dragon that until now only men were able to destroy and defeat?
Yeah, you know, if we look at the artwork of the illustration of Red Sonja, a warrior woman that generally doesn't wear a lot of armor. And we've always talked about there's a lot of satirical videos on YouTube making fun of female armor, rather than not either scantily clad or at least makes room in the bustier for boobs. They're like, you don't need that. You know that, right?
Exactly.
The armor accommodates. You don't need to have boob bulges in your breastplate.
Exactly.
But that's something that's kind of mandatory.
So
when Nick designed our artwork for Amethyst, he designed one of the female characters with a bare midriff. And I said, hey, Nick, do me a favor. Can you cover that up? Put some lamellar armor on that. And he was like, I'm so used to drawing female characters sexualized, I did it as a reflex. And so I said, no worries. And since then, he's always covered up his female characters, like realistically.
Okay. Right? So the point that you were trying to make, what happens if somebody draws something? Does that mean that they share those views? Well, it might, it may not, but they certainly share the ethics of the person who commissioned the work. If somebody asks you to write something that is inappropriate, you can always say no. So from that point of view, I wouldn't question the quality of the artwork. It might be an absolutely beautiful piece, but I would question their ethics. Because, as I said, they can always say no. And if they say yes, okay, then you're valuing the money above what, people may make of your own work and what other people can suffer. Now, I know that this is a very privileged position to talk about because they may not have another commission. They may need the money to, make ends meet. So that's putting the artist in a very, very tricky position. But that is mostly because artists don't get paid enough. But that is a different topic altogether because they shouldn't be put in that position.
Of union busting. There was a story recently about Walmart. I can't remember, Walmart hired a company, or Kellogg's hired a company for union busting. And this company created videos that could be generically used by any company to help promote anti-union beliefs. The irony is that the actors in those videos were part of the Actors Guild. And so when people approach the actors, they're like, it was a paycheck. So, so the situation where they did it, even though it was a hypocrisy because they themselves were union people who supported the union. And one of the actors came out and said he supports the union. He did that job because it was a paycheck.
Exactly. So it's a very unfair and is a very, very difficult position. But if you do it again and again and again, for instance, your friend, you told him, hey, why don't you write it down? He said, well, this is a reflex. And he's changed since. That speaks volumes. If he had continued to do exactly the same thing, then it would have been, dude, you've been told. It's not necessary. So now that speaks good of him. That is a good thing.
Well, he, like you said, he was somewhat relieved because he was, as a person who was a father of four daughters, he obviously didn't really care for that kind of idea. And so I said, no, please do it normally. But I'm not happy with the original Foundations cover, but that was forced on me. So that was put in a situation where I could have put my foot down and I didn't. So that's something my regret of the original Foundations book. But I made a point that all my future books don't follow that pattern. Well, and going back to about... Go ahead.
Sorry, no. And that's the thing that I think way too many times people forget, and way too many times is not taken into account when we boycott other people. And is that I personally believe in redemption. I believe in being able to admit that you've made a mistake, learn from your mistake, make reparations. This is important. You have to make reparations and not make the mistake again. I think that opportunity should be given to most people. If they refuse or they keep on making the mistake by accident, you know, once by accident, fine. Twice by accident, okay. Three, no, that's no accident. You were trying to do it on purpose and you're just taking the piss. No. So yeah. I think people, we need to be nuanced and, you know, hold our breath.
And this is also recent too, because Foundations came out in 2010. That's only 12 years ago. And if it came out today, it never would have passed certification.
Absolutely.
It would have hit so many walls. If the public found out, there would be controversy. People would go scream. It would be a Twitter battle. 12 years ago, though, that was the mainstay. Like, I had to fight against it, and I lost. And I could have put my foot down, but I didn't, because this was my first wide publication.
Exactly.
Nowadays, of course, you wouldn't be caught dead with a cover like that, and I wouldn't have done it. But it was interesting that this is not only like, oh, this has been away for a long. No, this is something that's 7 or 8 years old. Like, this is something people still have to get with the times and learn. Going to what you're saying about, once again, sexualizations of female characters. I understand your point, because we're exaggerating the masculine finishes of a man, but we're sexualizing the women, so it's different. I can get that. I'm going to make a point of having a male illustration. I'm going to give him a very large, massive package, and the woman's going to be massively armor clad, just to make a point. But this brings up the Tiny Epic Dungeons controversy, because the Tiny Epic Dungeons earlier this year produced a Kickstarter. Gamelin Games produced it, and the game was called Tiny Epic Dungeons. And they had your spattering of classic fantasy characters, like as cliched as you could possibly be. Elves, dwarves, halflings, spiders. And of course, the fighter was a typical male fighter. And the female was typically lesser clothed with a relatively large rack. Mm-hmm. Not a huge rack. It wasn't as bad as you might think. But it wasn't, I wouldn't even noticed it normally, but people did. And specifically, Elizabeth Hargrave did, the creator of Wingspan, and she put them to task, and it followed, because she has a lot of supporters, a wave of people criticizing Gamelin for the cover. Mm-hmm. So, a few weeks into the production, into the Kickstarter, they pulled back and released a new cover that was different. But that, of course, bounced back and had a lot of people going, you shouldn't have bent to this pressure. It's just an illustration. She's bullshit. Not naked, so forth. And this, like I said, when I looked at it, there was a part of me, because of my past, going instinctually going, you know, this is classic fantasy. This is how a fantasy has been drawn for over 100 years. And artists like Hariyama and Boris Vallejo, I'm going to get that wrong.
Vallejo.
Have been doing, I'm Portuguese, I should be able to say it. But the point is the fact that these guys, their whole career was based off of the sexualization of and the imagery. But at that point, I started reading the comments, and the people that were supporting of the original cover, they were saying other things that were raising red flags. And I'm like, okay, no, I am not going to support this line of conversation, because I'm seeing who are agreeing with that. So I said, you know what? There's no harm in changing the cover. They did it. It was the right thing to do, and we'll move on from that. But there was a reflex action in me that was like, wait, this is how fantasy has been done for 100 years. We've been, you know, I don't care for it. I did when I was a teenager, because I was a teenager, right? I would not buy these books nowadays, because I'm not interested in that illustration. I want hard sci-fi. I want spaceships and robots. But we see it with anime. Anime still, and they call it fan service. They cover the sexualization of women in these titles as fan service. We have fan service in Marvel. We have fan service in anime. We have fan service, and it is still happening. It hasn't stopped because of Tiny Epic Galaxies. Sorry, Tiny Epic Dungeons in January. It's been happening for 100 years. It still happens at this very moment. And a lot of people don't have a problem with it, especially in anime. I never see people criticizing anime for the sexualization of their female characters, even though they do it all the time. And then we see it reflected at conventions, where we see all these women dressing up in these characters from anime, and they are all incredibly scantily clad.
Okay.
And people look at it and go, why aren't we criticizing every single anime? Why did Tiny Epic Dungeons get thrown?
Different thing, because there are cultural differences that we have to acknowledge and keep in mind. And firstly, that sexualization does get criticized. I mean, we had not long ago, we had a massive issue with Dragon Ball because of the sexualization and the misogyny within Dragon Ball. And that's it. And you look at Mazinger now, and there is a massive criticism because of the sexualization and the way that women and, you know, the female mecha are portrayed. Aphrodite A, who actually only had one weapon, and it was to throw missiles off her bosoms. Hello? Hello? You know, and Mazinger was everything that was beautiful about a man. But anyway, so it does... That does happen, not as loudly as I think it should, but it does happen. And regarding the gambling, I think, again, we need to look at it with nuance. I think they did the right thing in changing the cover because they reacted to the market. The market said this is wrong, and because they are producing a product, they said, okay, the market doesn't want this, so we're going to change it. Would it have been different, though, if instead of a company like Gamelame, had been a company like just one person with a bare minimum budget for art who literally could not afford to change the cover? Yes, it would have been different. Would the cover have been any less shitty? No, it would have been just as shitty. But would the company have been just as liable? No, it wouldn't if they didn't take action. Gamelame did the right thing there. And as you said, people complaining about that probably are the kind of people who you wouldn't want to be associated with anyway, so screw them.
Yeah, because like I said, for me, as a person, like I'm not an artist. I'm not an artist from a visual style. I'm an artist because I'm a writer. Even just this year, I've been conscientiously approaching even the stuff I write and go, okay, is this appropriate? And sometimes I have to think and ask around and ask people. But when it comes to my visual art, I make a point of saying, you know, I want this to be realistic. I always go realistic. And, you know, if we have a female in armor, I want this armor to be armor that they would actually wear and not what people want to see. And that's kind of how I always approached it. And that's why my female characters, and funny thing is, I always tell Nick, by default, draw more female characters. And I always tell him to draw, yeah, draw female characters. He draws the most realistic female characters out there. Their breasts aren't huge. They are a good example, of course. Bringing up nothing else is this cover for my latest last Amethyst book, Factions. Now, I don't consider her sexualized. I consider it a pose. We have two people in equal stature. She's covered completely, literally head to toe. Her breasts aren't terribly massive. I mean, she definitely has a svelte figure.
But that's fine. I don't find that in illustration. I wish people could see that. That's a huge book.
Was that?
That's a huge book, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, I don't. Amethyst books aren't small. It's 400 pages.
No, that's why you haven't sent me one yet.
Yes, the Amethyst. Every book I have, all my major books, like even Affinity, is three books of 300 pages each.
Yeah, yeah. Change the subject now. I know. But I am an asshole.
Even the Affinity covers, which Nick is doing, they have a female on each cover, but none of them are scantily clad. None of them are. I always try to present them as a representation. But even as an artist, I look at what I write. And just recently, when I was writing the Affinity novel, I went back and changed the character's gender completely because I felt that there was an issue with representation.
Well, question for you: what would your friend say or think or react like if you actually asked him to draw or paint some LGBT scenes?
Well, that, I'm trying, of course, my instinct's like, what situation would I, I'm looking at the situation like, why, how would I do that? That's a very good point. Because I do have illustrations of heterosexuals in, like, there's literally, I'm not sure if it's this book, but there is actually an illustration of two people kissing. I have illustrations. I have that as well. And that's a very interesting point. I go, I was like, I want this to be two female characters in an embrace.
Or male.
I totally see that doing. Now that you mention it, it's something I want to do now. not to challenge him. I like the idea of just presenting it because I think it's cool to have two men, two women, or have characters, have a character that you don't know what their gender is, and to create that stuff. I mean, we were having conversations earlier about the fact that I was pushing Nick to draw less pure white characters, and he does it by instinct. I don't ask him. He presents me with non-white characters all the time without asking. He does it entirely on his own. But that was a conversation we had because he was sending me a bunch of characters that were all white. This is back in 2008. And I said, hey, can you spice it up a little bit? And he came back and said, sure, absolutely, no problem. And he also kind of stressed like, yeah, I have to be told this because they generally don't want it. But now it's changed. Society has changed. We are seeing that. But 2008, it wasn't. I know, and we had conversations about, you know, how important it was that Wizards of the Coast started having illustrations of black characters, and then a bunch of the independent artists have been like, we've been doing this for years.
Yes, exactly.
But that was another thing. So we have been in situations where I've asked him to take the sexualization out of women, add more interracial characters. So it's something that I definitely want to push. We're already done Affinity, and Affinity doesn't have any poses like that. It's just monsters and character classes. So I don't have an illustration where we have two people in one illustration. But it's something I definitely do want to look into for Amethyst, because I think it's important, because Amethyst is meant to be incredibly progressive, incredibly inclusive. Even though Affinity has a lot of that stuff as well. Affinity actually has two races where gender is fluid, and other ideas that I like playing with, because I think it actually gives me more creativity rather than being stifling. But that's a very interesting point. How he would react if I said, I would like an illustration, you know, can you give me the fantasy? I want to see Brokeback Mountain with two fighters, please.
There you go. See what happens. Anyway, yeah, we've been going for an hour and a quarter already. This podcast is turning out to be very long. So what conclusion have you reached? I mean, have you changed from the beginning of this conversation to now as to whether the artist and the art should be separated in their views, or?
Well, I was surprised by, like I said, your opinions are always very measured and sometimes surprising, because they're not knee jerk. They're very calculated. They're very honest, and they're also very measured. And I appreciate that, because in our society, even just recently, how some people can be reactionary and they jump on something without thinking things through. So I definitely agree with the idea of, you know, we're not going to criticize Gene Roddenberry's views now, because Star Trek has evolved to very differently from what his original views were. Even he has expressed, you know, regret. Yeah, I do feign ignorance, but I also kind of believe that I'm on pretty safe ground with the people I work with. But I do know that in the future, when I hire artists, not that I do it that often, or I hire anybody, that I basically do have to vet them, because I have to make sure that something doesn't rear its ugly head down the road. I want people to be angry at me for my political views, and not to go after me because of some of the views of my artists, unless they coincide with mine.
Which is fair enough. I mean, that would make a lot more sense. So, good. I think I think we're going to have people thinking quite a lot, I hope. And I would love to hear if they agree with us or not, or why, and email us or whatever. So people do say something.
But we agreed that the sexualization of women is something that's now dying.
Yeah,
like it's no longer pointless. Acceptable.
It's pointless. I mean, why would it even be there unless it's necessary for reasons that it would be very hard to justify? But
like I said, as the cover of Foundations was because men buy sex.
Yeah, I know, but
and that was that's the reason why all these illustrations were made in the first place.
Exactly,
men bought.
Exactly, but they were made for men. That's the thing that we need to keep in mind. They were made for also young men who wank five times a day. Anyway, that's the end of the podcast, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. It is truly wonderful to have you there and genuinely appreciate it. The GMS Magazine podcast is produced by Paco Garcia with assistance from Chris Diaz and Martin Reed and the amazing bunch of listeners all over the world. The theme tune is by Kev Atzet. Let me know what you think about the podcast by emailing me at podcast@gmsmagazine.com or on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter. I am at GMS Magazine and Chris is the As Ex Machina. And please remember to get in touch. Thank you very, very much indeed. And until the next time, game on.